I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today on the show, I welcome author Mary DeMuth. Mary is a prolific author of 30 books, averaging about 3 a year over the last 10 years. We have a really interesting talk about the things that have brought her to write what she has written, about parenting, and about how we can use community to help us in our healing and in our growth.
Wanting to connect with you for a while, and you are so productive that every time I turn around, there's a new book, and I'm like, oh, maybe I should talk about that one. Yeah. So for people who are unfamiliar with you, do you mind sharing a little bit of what you do and what you've done and what you're passionate about?
Sure. I've written 30 plus books now over the past 10 years, so about 3 books a year. I have spoken around the world about living an uncaged, freedom-infused life, so that's been really fun. I've got 3 kids and a husband, and I live in the Dallas, Texas area. My husband and I and our family were church planters in France in the mid-2000s. And other than that, I am a full-time author and writer.
And what does it mean to you when you say an uncaged life? How do we understand what that is?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm actually thinking about changing that just because it kind of is a little bit esoteric or not very concrete. But what I mean by that is having freedom from the past, being set free from the things that happened to you back then, so that to such an extent that no one would know that those things ever happened to you. So it's really about living a life of freedom and joy in the presence and in the present in abundance with an abundant mindset.
Absolutely. And I've noticed you have such an encouraging ministry. You reach out to the brokenhearted, and a lot of your books help people deal with trauma and recovery. And I know you're coming out with a new book soon, Not Marked. Is that right?
Yeah, that one actually came out about 2 years ago now, so that one's out.
Oh, okay, so I'm looking at old stuff, I think, on your website. But so what's the latest thing that you're working on?
Yeah, the latest one that just released was called The Day I Met Jesus, and that was a co-authorship with Frank Viola, and it's about 5 women of the New Testament who encountered Jesus, and I wrote their accounts, and he wrote the kind of the nonfiction So What. And then I am waiting for a book to release with Baker in spring of 2016, so next spring, called Worth Living, and that is about how to live in light of being a worthy person, or the fact that God is worthing us or granting us worth.
Oh, that's really interesting. So have your books evolved as you have, as your needs have changed?
I'm sure that they have, because every time I write a book, I get healed in some new way. It's kind of a cool way to have a healing journey, is just to write a book. It's kind of stressful, though, so I wouldn't recommend it to everybody with deadlines and everything. But yes, I do believe my message has evolved from being a bit introspective and thinking about the past too much to really this idea of a legacy and making your life what you want it to be.
And then the book about walling off your heart, maybe you can speak a little bit about that. When I originally was envisioning speaking with you and what we might talk about, there's, 25 things that pop into my mind. But one of the things that I was interested in is your take on suffering with a broken heart, even maybe not even realizing that, and then what can be done and about that in the first place. So maybe you can talk about why you wrote the book and then how it's touched people.
Yeah, that book has had a lot of impact on people's lives. I think primarily because we all can relate to it. And I wrote it because so many people I ran into had these broken hearts, and they would say things like, I was so burned in church, I'm never going back. Or, I was so hurt by somebody that I've decided not to ever open myself up, at least superficially. I'll open up superficially, but never deep again with anyone. And I realized that was a really sad way to live. And then, of course, I had to look at my own life and see how I was doing that. I definitely had some walls around my heart from trauma and tragedy. And, we all have it. I'm not you know, unique in that way. And I decided to kind of do an adventure through the Lord's Prayer. And that was what kind of the roadmap that God gave me was pray yourself through the Lord's Prayer as an avenue for healing and with a mind toward relationships. And so that's the premise of that book. It takes every phrase of the Lord's Prayer and helps you to have it be a vehicle of healing so that you can have an open-hearted life and no longer have a closed-hearted life.
And one of the really salient points you make is that we become brokenhearted because of people and disappointments, but often relationally, but also we're healed through the same way, through the same community, and not maybe the same people, but how does that work in your life? How has it worked, and how do you see that working out?
Yeah, I have a little story about that I shared in the book. And my husband and I, as I mentioned before, we were church planters in France, and we had a lot of relational heartache when we were there. It just was a difficult place. And so when we were coming home from that 2.5 year stint, we were coming home for good, and it felt like failure to us. And I remember just being on the plane thinking, I don't like people. And so I'm just not going to be friends with people anymore. I'll pet the dog, but I'm not going to be friends with people. And we landed in Dallas from France, and we had no car. We had no home. We had no keys. And we were borrowing a car to go stay in the corner of a barn. And this was about a week before Christmas. It was December 18th. I remember the day. And we were getting there late at night, and we got lost, and we were arguing and all that stuff. And we get to the corner of this barn, and it's a little apartment with two bedrooms. We've got three kids, so they're going to be bunking in one bedroom and us in the other. And it was all lit up. And when we got there, our friends were there, and there was music playing, and there was a Christmas tree, something I never thought that we would have that Christmas. There were cookies on the table. There was food in the pantry. Everything was all set up and sweet. We didn't have to do anything. All we had to do was get into bed. And that's when I realized that the very thing that wounds us is the thing that heals us. And that if I was going to wall off my heart forever, I was going to also wall it off from the people who did this outrageous, beautiful act.
That's so true. That the wall you build keeps out good, too.
Yes. And so, you know, we settle for this kind of neutral life where we say, okay, I'm going to make a determination never to be hurt. But then we might not have the pain that we would have had, but we don't have the joy either. We cut ourselves off from true, true life.
And then besides that experience of coming back and feeling burnt out with community, you were also, I'm sure, other things come up from your past as well as traumas that have walled you off from people or things that you didn't realize. And what became more clear as you worked through that?
I think, you know, we're always kind of grappling with stuff in the past. And I know for me, I've recognized recently, which has taken me years to come to this point of realizing that I am a girl who likes to be noticed. And I think it stems from a childhood where I felt like I was trying to do gymnastics all the time just to get people to notice me, jumping up and down, notice me. And that was probably a good coping mechanism back then because I needed some attention. I needed some help. But as an adult, it's kind of nauseating and running on the treadmill of I'll only be happy if someone notices me, especially as an author and speaker, is the worst treadmill to be on because ultimately you are going to continually be rejected. This is the worst industry to be in if you have that issue. And so it's been actually very good for me because all that rejection has helped me to go, okay, I am not the sum total of people noticing me. I am just beautifully loved by God.
I think that's, we live in a culture that's very narcissistic, but even I mean, narcissism is never good, but it's almost a toxic level where it's hard to find balance of when you can, I've just been doing live streaming, and that's really fun, and I use it for conveying, you know, content and topics and educational things, but there's a lot of people using it like, here's me working out, here's me eating cereal, here's, you know, and it's this, you know, attempt to, I think, find some worthiness in the attention of others.
Yes, I think it's really natural. And yeah, I think we do have, especially in the selfie era, we have this unhealthy occupation with our selfishness and what we want and what, you know, we become prima donnas demanding that everything come to us a certain way. And that was just the opposite of how Jesus lived his life. And I really looked to him as an example of, he said, even the Son of God did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So even he, who was God, did not lord that over everyone. He just came there to serve people. And I think I'm happiest, definitely happiest, when I'm serving people versus whether I'm trying to make people like me or fill my ego.
One of the things that I was thinking about is, as people who feel brokenhearted want to reconnect again with people, they need to really find safe people first and not just anyone, right? And, you know, how would you suggest people sort of navigate that terrain to get back into community? Because it's one thing, like the community of, let's say, you know, social media isn't going to be the kind of community we're talking about to find healing.
No, exactly. And in The Wall Around Your Heart, I have a long list of, you know, kind of traits of safe people. But I think we all kind of, if we've been around the block a little bit, we kind of know who a safe person is. It's someone who can keep a confidence. It's someone who asks more questions than tells us more stuff we need to do. It's someone who has our best in mind. It's someone who's willing to tell us the hard things and yet walk alongside us with, you know, when we're going through hard things. And I have found that oftentimes the first people I'm attracted to, I've moved around a lot. So, you know, you kind of are new in new areas. I usually, those first people I'm attracted to are not the right people for me. They're not usually the people I end up being close friends with. And it's the counterintuitive ones that are kind of on the back, you know, kind of on the back wall, so to speak. And those people end up being amazing friends. And so I always think it's kind of funny how we tend to look at the outside of folks and we kind of assess and we look and we judge. But I have found if I'm a little more settled and quiet and I let kind of life happen a little more naturally and let the relationships kind of fall where they may, I'm always very surprised at the ones that stay and the ones that don't.
And I wonder, do you sense that you're drawn to people at first out of admiring them, or do you find that in some way they sort of carry some old pain that feels familiar that you're drawn to?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I'm better with that now. I think definitely in my 20s and 30s, I was gravitating toward wounded people, and wounded people are great, but they are also wounded. So you have to be kind of cautious about getting enmeshed too much or trying to rescue, because I definitely like to rescue folks. So, and I'm not really the one equipped to do that. Not really a good thing.
Yeah, I think we can definitely be drawn to people where we have a lot of empathy with them. But that's, you know, I'm thinking the difference between ministry and friendship. You know, those people are fine to become friends with in more of a ministry sense. But it's much harder to find the safety and health that you need from those same people.
Right. Good point.
So how have you, I know you know, since you're a mom, you know, what ways have you seen that you can help your children? Like, I always think of, how can I break the cycle with my children? Things that I don't want them to experience where maybe I've tripped up. And obviously they'll have different struggles than, you know, kids have different struggles than their parents for sure. But, you know, for your children, how do you see their lives, how do you see teaching them about the things that you don't want them to experience like you do?
Well, I think it's really through conversational parenting, having lots and lots of conversations, being ready and available. Even last night, my daughter came into my room and you could tell she just wanted to talk. So I just sat there and she said things and I listened, and that's how it is. The other thing I would say is modeling. So I try to model authenticity. I try to model authentic faith. I try to model, you know, being real. And I don't want to present to my kids that I have everything all together. So they get, what you see is what you get with me. And so I think a lot of that, I think that's very powerful. I think when kids rebel, and not to say that kids in a good home won't rebel, because they could do that as well, but they tend to rebel when what you say is different than how you act. And so my heart has been to really be aligned in those two ways, and also to be very, very consistent in what I do and say. Now, that all being said, I'm a very imperfect parent, and but I think I have erred rightly on the side of conversation and spending time with my kids.
Yeah, I have felt in my own parenting that I really didn't have the tools or the formative background to make me a sort of stable, consistent parent. Not to say anything bad about my own parents who tried as best they could, but also there was just a lot of inconsistency in our lives. And the one thing I've tried to give my children is stability in, you know, we actually haven't moved around a lot, though I did as a child, but also the emotional and relational stability between me and my husband. But I've also noticed that, you know, they are going to have their own struggles with their own things. And I've thought, as we've bumped into obstacles, I have really had to say to myself, this, because things might be going badly right now, that's not the end of this story. And our relationship is, it's kind of like a story that is moving from chapter to chapter. And I think it helps to, for me anyway, to not see it as, oh, that went bad, or this week hasn't gone well, and so now things are really, you know, tanking. Because I notice that it's easier sometimes to be productive in other areas of your life where you see results, and those relational things are the tougher things to gauge that you're gaining any ground on.
Yeah, that's very true, but they're the most important thing. And I think that's why people become alcoholics or workaholics or whatever-aholics, because you can kind of, especially as a workaholic, you can measure what you've done, but it's not as easy to measure your relationships and say, oh yes, I've been very successful. Mm-hmm. Besides the fact that in a relationship, one person could just totally wig out and you have no control mm-hmm. over that. So then you could never get, you know, gauge your success based on a prodigal or someone who ran away, you know? Yeah. So it's you have to be careful in those realms.
Yeah, I agree. It's much more, the ground, you can't feel your way around all the time. It's, you know, these darker portions. But it's true, at the end of your life, you know, your accomplishments and your titles and whatever impact you had is really often measured in your relationships. You can be, you know, wealthy and powerful, and then if you haven't made any connections, any real connections, then you're left with pretty empty situation.
Very true.
So how old are your children?
They're not really children anymore. So they are 22, 19, and 17.
Okay, so there's some home. Is your oldest not at home anymore?
She actually came back mm-hmm. after graduating, and she just got she'll probably be moving out. And then my youngest is a daughter, and she's a senior in high school. My son's in college.
Wow, so it really is, the nest is starting to empty out a little bit for you.
It is.
Yeah, that's interesting to see your kids, to see your kids kind of in their own right, coming into their own and navigating the world. And what's that been like? Are you going to write a book about that too?
No, I think that's been one of the hardest parts of parenting, actually. Mm-hmm. And there isn't a lot of, you know, literature out there about launching your kids. There's everything about, you know, being a mom to toddlers, being a mom to teens. But there's not much about, okay, how to be a mom or be a parent of a 21-year-old or 22-year-old who's looking for their first job and going through an identity crisis and mm-hmm. all of that. I mean, it's definitely a new era.
Right. Yeah.
And I think, you know, when we were younger, at least for me, when I left the nest at, you know, 18 to go to college, I never came back really. And I didn't go home for support. And so there wasn't really much need for a launch because I kind of launched myself. Mm-hmm. But in this kind of new world that we live in, this is part of the role that I play.
Right. Yeah. I wonder if that's actually, you know, people talk about the boomerang kids who come back after a few years away, working or something like that. And it's been treated kind of negatively, but I'm wondering if eventually, though, the relationships get tighter. If there's not a lot of dysfunction in there, then maybe it's actually more bonding, because we can tend to be pretty autonomous and just, you know, make our own way and then act very independent and not be as interdependent maybe on family as would be, you know, the most optimal.
True. And, you know, family looks different for everybody. And so I would never say, well, never have a boomerang kid or kick all your kids out of the house at a certain age or whatever. I mean, you just kind of go with what's dealt with you, you know, dealt your way and navigate it.
So maybe you can just share a little bit as we sort of run to a close a little bit, but I actually would like to get into the book that's coming out a little bit more. Could you get into some of the topics a little bit more?
Sure. On the Worth book, is that what you're asking?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in that book, I think I tried to look at the ways I tried to prove my worth. And then in those ways I tried to prove my worth, I looked at the lies that I was believing. And one of those lies that I tackle is, I am what I produce. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, you know, with 30 books, I should just be super happy, you know, like, oh my gosh, I just wrote 30 books. But when you are a doer like me, there's never any victory. There's only another mountain. So you climb Mount Rainier and you get to 14,410 feet. You don't stop. You don't stick a flag on the top. You don't jump up and down. You're not grateful that you didn't die, because you can die there.
Mm-hmm.
You find the next mountain, and eventually you get to Everest, but you never celebrate every mountain that you've been on. And so our worth can't be determined by the next big thing that we're trying to do. It's something more foundational. It's something where our feet are on solid ground. And, you know, Jesus mentioned that it's the rock, and having this kind of rock bedrock foundation of knowing you are a loved person, mm-hmm. and that there's nothing you can do outside of that is really important. And so the book is really about the lies that we believe about our worth. One of the chapters is about your worth is based on how you look, which can work really great when you're awesome in your 20s, but every year is a little bit closer to death. So, and every year things start changing.
Right.
And so if your security is based on something so fleeting as your looks or your youth or your ability to run a mile in a certain amount of time, then you will constantly be disappointed for the rest of your life. It cannot be on transitory things.
How true. Yeah. And I think that is kind of how we're geared. I'm socially maybe thinking about our accomplishments or about, you know, I can, there really are a lot of sort of mixed messages we get about what makes us worthy and what doesn't. And so many of them are really not, they're not stable at all. They're actually going to give way right beneath us.
Exactly. And we need to settle that. We need to settle our worth, because if you meet someone who's settled their worth, their whole life is full of kind of spontaneous, irresistible joy, because they know that it doesn't matter if everything bad happens to them. It doesn't matter if things get taken away from them. It doesn't matter if they have ill health. They have this deep sense of knowing that they're going to be okay based on, you know, something solid.
So did you have sort of an epiphanal moment about that? Or are there kind of things that you practice to sort of almost build a muscle to remember your worth?
All those things, and I'm still in the
middle
of it. So I'm a messy person who wrote a messy book, probably is a better way to say it, because I still struggle with it. I would be lying to the reader, and I'd not promise the book, but I would be lying if I said, oh yeah, I've got this all figured out, so I wrote this book, or I had this epiphany, so I wrote this book. It's more like, hey, we're all in this big boat together of unworthiness, and let's sail and try to figure it out.
Mary, I think I'm picking up a little static. Can we just see it? It sounded real feedbacky for a second there. I just want to make sure we're good. Maybe you could... One of the things, I'll let you know if it comes back up again.
Okay.
I'm sure that as you're writing, you've developed a loyal readership who look forward to each one of your books. And I'm kind of curious as to some of the feedback that you've gotten in your most recent books. Do people tend to reach out to you and say that something helped them or share their stories with you?
Yes, very often. I get those emails a lot, and I'm so, so grateful for that reader feedback because, you know, this usually a book was written about a year prior or 2 years prior to it releasing. And then once it releases, you don't usually know if it's okay or if it helped anybody. So it's always great to get feedback, especially, you know, that I think that's one reason why I like speaking so much, because when I'm speaking, I can have immediate feedback from, okay, this message is working. People are getting something from it based, you know, instead of waiting 2 years to get some feedback. Yeah. But yes, people tell me their stories. They say me too. And to me, that's the ultimate success of a writer, is that your readers can say me too.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, do you wind up speaking about the topics in an upcoming book, or do you wind up speaking about the topics after a book has been released?
Both of those things. I try to meld my speaking to the needs of the group. So it might involve old messages or new messages. I'm working on a series of new ones right now. So it just depends.
And do you have some other books in the works or in the hopper as you're considering what you'll write next beyond the next one?
I don't. I have a completed manuscript that is a novel, and I'm waiting to hear back on that. And then I've got a couple feelers out there for a couple books I'd like to write, but I don't have anything right now.
Yeah. Well, not that you have to. you could certainly take. Now, being that you are so productive and you are prolific as an author, I'm wondering, how do you know when to pull back before you get burned out? Or, I mean, I'm sure it's also a messy situation at times, but what do you do to actually kind of feel like you're in your body again and actually give yourself enough rest? What are some of the things that help you?
One of the things that's really helped me is just taking a walk every day. It really centers me and helps me to regroup and be quiet and, you know, to kind of reconnect with myself and with my life and with my God. So that has been really, really helpful. And I have really jumped off a treadmill. I was on it for probably of the last 10 years, the eight prior to that. So for the past 2 years, I've been a lot better at resting. But up until that point, I was truly a workaholic.
Yeah. It's easy to do too, because you feel like, I mean, I know the work never quite seems to be done. And I think if you're working at home as a writer, you're thinking, oh, well, I could just do this one more thing.
Right. Yes. It's, I could always be doing 10 more.
Right. And then you have probably plenty of ideas, and there they all are kind of popping up like popcorn. And you think, well, if I don't capture some of these down, then what'll happen, you know? But, well, I will let you get back to your day, but I just wanted to say thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. And I know that people will be, I'll be listing your books in the show notes. Not all 30 probably, but
don't do that. It would be overwhelming.
At least a little mini library there, and let you know when this is going to go live. And I just really appreciate both your work and your ministry, but also just your generosity in speaking with me.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Did you know that every episode of Spark My Muse has show notes? You can find show notes at sparkmymuse.com, and in those show notes you'll find details about the people, books, and resources that were mentioned in the show. And sometimes you'll find photos and embedded videos too. I hope you'll stop by and check it out. Every Tuesday night, we get together on blab.im/LisaDelay to discuss the show released that day.